We're actually going to start off this episode with a warning, which is we're normally quite careful about not using bad language and keeping the show clean. But the book we're talking about today makes that difficult, both because of what it contains in itself, some sexual violence, some kind of unavoidably weird, kinky S&M sort of subtext, and some extremely reprehensible political messaging. And on top of that, it's made both of us quite angry, particularly you, because of having to read it. So all things considered, I don't know how many people play this podcast to young children, but you might skip this one.
Is this the most grossly offensive book you've ever read? I mean, for me, it's probably not as strangely offensive as Mein Kampf, but it's sort of, really, I really genuinely think it's toddling in that direction.
You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
And I'm George Gingell.
And we're talking about... So this week, we've been talking about... We're going to be talking about Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead.
Why?
There are various answers. I mean, one of them is that it's probably the most successful fictional depiction of an architect.
Yeah.
For better or worse.
You love this shit.
Howard Rourke laughed. He stood naked at the edge of a cliff. The lake lay far below him. A frozen explosion of granite burst in flight to the sky over motionless water. The water seemed immovable, the stone flowing. The stone had the stillness of one brief moment in battle, when the thrust meets thrust and the currents are held in a pause more dynamic than motion. The wind waved his hair against the sky. His hair was neither blonde nor red, but the exact colour of ripe orange rind. He looked at the granite, to be cut, he thought, and made into walls. He looked at a tree, to be split and made into rafters. He looked at a streak of rust on the stone and thought of iron ore under the ground, to be melted and to emerge as girders against the sky. That flame-haired hero standing there on the rock is Howard Rourke, the protagonist of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, the enormously lengthy story of one indefatigable, single-minded architect's battle to fulfill his own personal creative vision in the face of the opposition of a corrupt, servile, and hypocritical establishment who will stop at nothing to tear down anyone who defies the wishes of the collective. The Fountainhead was published in 1943, and it was Rand's first big success, becoming a bestseller. She sold the movie rights and wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation, which was released in 1949. It sold over 6 million copies. It's a book which you may well, I hope not, have read, but have probably heard of, and we've done it so that you don't have to.
I thought we should have an advice. I thought we should later on have an advice section for people who liked
the... Obviously, there are some people who do.
If you look on the internet, there are a lot of people being very praising.
Yeah, some people love it. Should we just say a couple of things about Rand herself so we don't have to say it later? She's born Elisa Zinovyevna Rosenbaum in St. Petersburg. So she lived through the early part of the Russian Revolution and then moved to the States in the mid-20s.
I think you should say a little bit more about her background, because it does have...
What do you want to say about her?
I want to say that she was a sort of haute bourgeois, but not the very top of the haute bourgeois, daughter of a successful businessman, had a lot of property, Jewish sort of, not intellectual, but, you know, in that sort of milieu. They have their property more or less taken away in the communist revolution, although she still lives a pretty privileged life. Studies at university, is briefly kicked out, along with, there was a bourgeois, anti-bourgeois purge of the university, and then they were all let back in. I'm not entirely sure of the politics of how this happened. The explanations given on Wikipedia don't make much sense.
Oh, you're revealing our sources there.
Yeah, quality stuff. Slightly corroborated wiki reading. And she writes a little bit about cinema, particularly about femme fatales, and then goes to New York and works in Hollywood, actually, as a sort of subscript, like writing assistant, basically, for a bit. And then sort of knocks around writing for that sort of thing, trying to get into, like, sci-fi. And then writes this book, and it's very successful.
So she kind of lived through the best bit of the Russian Revolution. I mean, not that it was all laugh a minute. There was like a big civil war and everything, but it's also the avant-garde bit when all the really interesting art and architecture was being produced. And it's certainly some time before it got really grim.
Before the state got really grim. I would say conditions were still fairly... I would think she was probably completely insulated, given her class, from the privations of the First War, but probably less thoroughly insulated. There was a civil war in which most of the agricultural land ended up with the other side.
In the introduction, which she wrote for a reprint 25 years later, she said that her goal was the projection of an ideal man. So this is who Rourke is. He's a demonstration of the principles of a philosophy she called objectivism, which is a sort of supposedly rational justification of egoism in place of altruism, a kind of worship, secular, of the independent self, and a rejection of all external sources of authority or guidance to the individual. And she has this quotation which was originally at the start of the text and she later took out by Nietzsche: the noble soul has reverence for itself. I think what happened is that she later then actually read some other Nietzsche and discovered that she didn't really agree with him that much and took it out.
I think actually she took it out because she said she had no philosophical influences apart from Aristotle. And that became more and more important to her, that her ideas were completely her own.
Do you want to stand alone against the whole world? There's no place for originality in architecture. Nobody can improve on the buildings of the past. One can only learn to copy them. We've tried to teach you the accepted historical style. You refuse to learn. You won't consider anybody's judgment but your own. You insist on designing buildings that look like nothing ever built before. This school has no choice but to expel you. It's my duty as your dean to say you'll never become an architect.
So we commence at the fictional Stanton University, only a few weeks before graduation, where Howard Rourke has just been expelled. He finishes swimming. I think he puts his clothes back on. He walks back into town and goes to see the dean, where he has this final face-off with...
There's quite a lot of sort of incidental stuff along the way. There's the funny sort of setup with... he lives in the same house as one of the other characters, as a lodger, and there's a confrontation with the mum, and there's a meeting people on the way back. But all of that is fairly... I mean, it's sort of setting up characters.
So the dean wants to give Rourke one last chance to not be expelled. He recognises his brilliance as the person with an understanding of structural principles, but he can't deal with the fact that he's unwilling to adopt the acceptable style of architecture at that university, which is classical.
It's Beaux-Arts. It's not really classical. It's like Beaux-Arts styles. Yeah.
Why do you want me to think that this is great architecture? He pointed to the picture of the Parthenon. That, said the dean, is the Parthenon. So it is. I haven't the time to waste on silly questions. All right then. Rourke got up and he took a long ruler from the desk. Shall I tell you what's rotten about it? It's the Parthenon, said the dean. Yes, goddammit, the Parthenon. The ruler struck the glass over the picture. Look, said Rourke. The famous flutings on the famous columns, what are they there for? To hide the joints in the wood. When columns were made of wood, only these aren't, they're marble. The triglyphs, what are they? Wood. Wooden beams. The way they had to be laid when people began to build wooden shacks. Your Greeks took marble, and they made copies of their wooden structures out of it, because others had done it that way. Then your masters of the Renaissance came along and made copies in plaster, of copies in marble, of copies in wood. Now here we are making copies in steel and concrete, of copies in plaster, of copies in marble, of copies in wood. Why? The dean sat watching him curiously. Rules, said Rourke. Here are my rules. What can be done with one substance must never be done with another. No two materials are alike. No two sites on earth are alike. No two buildings have the same purpose. The purpose, the site, and the material determine the shape. Nothing can be reasonable or beautiful unless it's made by one central idea, and the idea sets every detail. So we see straight away, like, Rourke's quarrel with the architectural establishment is that he wants to build in a modern way, And they are insisting that all architecture has to be built within some kind of idea of the classical tradition. And this is the battle which is going to wage all the way through. Right from the start, there's a particular way in which people react to Rourke, which is like they kind of hate him and can't get on with him, but they're always impressed by him.
Yeah, so in the earlier discussion, most of the faculty is horrified with his individualism and creative genius and inability to knuckle down and do what he's told in an academic setting. But his maths and structures professor is a great defender of him and will defend him at any cost.
Yeah. I think we should sort of say straight away that it's very problematic for him to be identified as modernist, because actually the sort of the vision of him which she wants to give us is someone who doesn't have any ideas apart from their own ideas. And that, like, modernism or functionalism or any of these things, they all have these kind of justifications which go back to something else which Rand would have found, like, repulsive. So they go back to this idea of using material in an economical way.
Well, I mean, she talks quite a bit about the value of using materials in an economical way.
But as we heard in the opening quotation, like, Rourke thinks mountains are there to be turned into little blocks of stone and, like, trees are there to be cut down.
He cannot see nature without wanting to turn it into parking lots. Like, I mean, it really is like, ooh, yeah. Look at that beautiful tree. I could turn it into plywood. Look at that mountain. I could make it into concrete roads. Like, I would say for most people, beauty arises out of more than it being a fundamental universal virtue that is created from thought. It arises from a response to human nature or a response to the human condition in some way. You know, buildings are attractive to people who exist in a phenomenal world because of some things about people and culture and their use, and they are attractive for various reasons. That's not the thought world that Rand's in. She's in one where things are beautiful because of the singular vision and genius instilled in them by a great man. Also, an important part of that, I think, what I was trying to say is, if she's not someone who understands emotions or thinks that they're relevant, it is vital to strip out any consideration for other people's feelings. That is the real key insight, if you want to call it, of this book and of her whole thought world. This is the sort of architectural implication of that, which is that you must shed all sort of historicist implication, but also all implication which is about appealing to people through an understanding of what delights or interests them, or, you know, all the things that we sort of regard as virtuous. And that's because she doesn't sort of acknowledge that a function... she sort of acknowledges buildings are good functionally and bad functionally, yeah. But the key thing about them is that they are applications of a key individual inspiration.
Yeah, there's a strange thing where it's like she's sort of interested in the idea of function, but she's not the idea of things which come out of that, like the sort of existence minimum or a kind of utilitarian approach to architecture. Like, she wouldn't be interested in those things because she doesn't actually care about the people who are going to be living in them.
Yeah, and actually all the things that, like, the ultimate things that he's aspiring to are functionless. They are just monuments to the individual's ego.
So he's expelled. He's spent his whole university career warring with these professors, designing these, like, wacky buildings. He's presented to us with this unbelievable backstory as the ideal man. He apparently has no parents, has worked on building sites since he was like a six-year-old or something.
He has to arise out of nothing.
He's kind of self-creating. He can do anything, everything is kind of created out of willpower.
He's a messiah, but it's something that's really important about him is that he doesn't come from people. He, like, rises out of the earth.
Orange haired.
Bright orange haired. There's another bit where she describes his gorgeous, veiny, hard, veiny hands.
So the other thing which is introduced right at the start is he has this buddy who he works with, Peter Keating, who is the kind of the antithesis of Rourke as a student. He knows exactly what people want and gives it to them. He's been awarded all the prizes. Their two kind of parallel developments are a lot of what the kind of early part of the book is about. So the young architects go to where the action is, to New York. Peter Keating is taken on by the most successful, by the most fashionable architect in New York, Guy Francon.
I guess I don't have to tell you that Guy Francon is the leading architect in the country.
No, you don't have to.
And quickly begins to make progress at work and in society. And Howard Rourke is only prepared to work for one man, the burnt-out old modernist Henry Cameron, who built one major building years ago and is now scraping by, drunk most of the time, defeated by society, doing anything which he can get his hands on.
Why do you want to work for me? You're setting out to ruin yourself, you know that, don't you? I ought to throw you out of here right now before it's too late.
I wish I'd done this at your age.
Oh, why did you have to come to me? I'm perfectly happy with the drooling dolts I've got. I don't want any fool visionaries starving around here. You're an egotist. You're impertinent. You're too sure of yourself. 20 years ago, I'd have punched your face with the greatest of pleasure. You're coming to work for me tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. No. Now leave these here. Now get out. Wait. What's your name?
Howard Rourke.
I think it's worth describing a couple of the things about both of the architectural practices, because both of them have things that are quite interesting. In the book, the first 200 pages are relatively good.
The book is divided up into these sections. There's four parts, and each of the first three parts is named after one of these great, like, rivals of Howard Rourke. And the first part is Peter Keating.
And the rivals are all other models for greatness. They're not other models for people. They're other models for achievement.
And as you say, like, this early part of the book, actually, there were lots of bits that I rather enjoyed. The sort of settings of this early part of the book have a kind of hallucinatory kind of intensity. They're very, very exaggerated. They feel a bit like the sets of sort of 1920s movies, you know, these, like, you know, the like insurance office in The Crowd or something, where it's like 2,000 people all working in parallel desks and kind of typing away. There's a sort of intensification, yeah, of all
or
the
almost
qualities.
A sort of Busby Berkeley, like all of the desks get wheeled on and then sort of spin around.
yeah. Shall I read a little bit of the description of Guy Francon's office, because it is quite cool? He turned to the door. It was a miniature Doric portico, every inch of it scaled down to the exact proportions decreed by the artists, who had worn flowing Grecian tunics. Between the marble perfection of the columns, a revolving door sparkled with nickel plate, reflecting the streaks of automobiles flying past. Keating walked through the revolving door, through the lustrous marble lobby, to an elevator of gilt and red lacquer that brought him, 30 floors later, to a mahogany door. He saw a slender brass plate with delicate letters. Francon and Heyer, Architects. The reception room of the office of Francon and Heyer looked like a cool, intimate ballroom in a colonial mansion. The silver-white walls were panelled with flat pilasters. The pilasters were fluted and curved into Ionic snails. They supported little pediments broken in the middle to make room for half a Grecian urn plastered against the wall. Etchings of Greek temples adorned the panels, too small to be distinguished, but presenting the unmistakable columns, pediments, and crumbling stone.
Sounds quite fun, actually.
It's quite enjoyable.
It's quite good. This stuff hadn't ever happened yet, but it would happen in the future.
It was actually starting to happen around the time she died.
Funded by exactly the people she loved. In fact, it sort of became their house style.
Yeah, what's bizarre is she's describing, like, exactly the style of like, Randian predator capital, basically.
Yeah.
whereas her like, modernism would become the house style of sort of soft socialism.
And hard socialism.
Yeah.
And in fact, what is the house style of the radical communists of her youth?
Well, yeah, like...
Like functionalism. Like functionalism and constructivism.
Yeah, the office of Francon and Heyer, we actually spend most of our time with Peter Keating, or certainly the most vividly described part is this kind of the rise of Peter Keating. He goes to this office. There's a rather lovely description of the copying room, which I think is sort of vaguely accurate. So, like, because in the age of no computers, you just have these, like, tables and tables of people all drawing away drawing boards. He has to put on a special grey smock, which I think is designed by the architect, everyone wearing identical ones. So probably so that your tie doesn't like rub on the drawings or something.
It's just because otherwise you get everything dirty. It's like an artist smock. Yeah. People wore them, definitely. There's lots of good photographs.
So I've written down here that he plays this kind of Game of Thrones, largely at the instigation of his mother, who is this disappointed woman who is living vicariously through her son and who, like, never misses an opportunity to tell him some sort of cynical ploy which he can do to get ahead.
And the purpose of this is to undermine him.
Yeah.
He's a character who... There are a lot of ways where the story sort of sees a natural path of a narrative and veers away from it.
Yeah.
So he's the character who would make a lot more sense as a protagonist.
Yeah.
He has some limited inner life, and his story is kind of somewhat sympathetic. He's not this sort of Iron Man. He's driven by insecurities, but he achieves stuff because of his brilliance, which is a much more naturally attractive protagonist. But the way she gets around this is by constantly undermining him and making him look like a fool. He's constantly henpecked by his mother and does exactly what his mummy's boy. He keeps waking up in the flat of his employer in pyjamas. It's definitely meant to be that they're like having some gay affair, right?
I don't really know. Okay, well, I mean, we should explain how we get there. So Keating arrives. He very quickly sort of starts to get on well with the like big boss, and simultaneously to try and undermine and replace all the kind of intermediate managers between him and the big boss. So the kind of studio manager, he starts saying, "Oh, I'll just do that bit of work for you." And gradually undermines him, and then figures out a way to get him fired so that he can be the boss of the studio. And then he finds out a way to replace the chief designer. And then it ends up that he's like, within, you know, a few months, he's the most important person in the office apart from the director. And they hang out lots. And yeah, then they go out and get drunk all the time, and he keeps waking up in silk pyjamas in the office.
Again, there's a bit when he's like, "Oh, I seem to be waking up in my pyjamas a lot in this..."
Yeah, hang on, let me see if there's a quotable bit. He sat on the floor, his head resting against the edge of a couch, his bare feet stretched out, a pair of Guy Franquin's chartreuse pyjamas floating loosely around his limbs. Through the open door of the bathroom, he saw Franquin standing at the washstand, his stomach pressed to its shining edge, brushing his teeth. "That's splendid," said Franquin, munching through a thick foam of toothpaste. "That'll do just as well, don't you see?" Well, I don't know really, but that doesn't really make sense. Yeah, I would say there's some sort of subtext.
It's funny because she's deeply conflicted because she hates gays.
Yeah.
But the only thing that's worth anything in the world is men looking at men and finding them powerful.
Yeah, it's sort of strange. I mean, as we'll see, like, Rand is like deeply... She's deeply misogynist. She doesn't believe that women are really capable of anything at all.
They can suffer. That's the only thing they can do with any virtue. They can be needlessly sacrificed.
She is only interested in men. She kind of wants to be a man. She also, like, finds men very sexy. So the way that she writes men, they all seem...
She wants to be James Bond, and she wants to have sex with James Bond.
At the same time, yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah, so the men, although they're all written as straight, do seem very gay all the time. And there are lots of moments... this is by no means the best of these moments. They get pretty good. Very quickly, Peter Keating and Guy Franquin, who's the director, are off kind of whining and dining all of these like society heiresses. And
Franquin is obsessed with like ties. He doesn't do any designing. He's like the completely decadent core of this huge design practice.
Yeah, yeah.
But because he went to the Ecole des Beaux-Arts, everyone flocks to his door and they all give him projects.
So Peter Keating, at the same time, he has these relationships with women. He has this this kind of girlfriend who he's had for a long time, who's this girl called Katie, who is...
Could you determine any characteristics of Katie?
Like, Katie is like this deeply pathetic girl who's written in such a bizarre way.
It's like 0.2 of a person. It's like, I mean, you know, if it was a sketch, it would just be like 1 foot and one... shoulder or something.
Yeah, so she's this sort of like pathetic kind of servile character, this sort of emotional woman who will end up like dedicating her life to others.
Literally, the only thing she does is say she adores him, and he's like, yeah, okay. And then goes back. And then every now and again he thinks, yeah, whatever, maybe I'll pay her a visit.
But then at the instigation of his mother, we'll go into this more later, but he becomes aware that the boss has a daughter, and that perhaps the best way to really like set him up as the future partner for Guy Francon is to get into it with his daughter, who's this journalist called Dominique Francon, this ice princess who will become increasingly important as the story goes on.
And is a really strange character.
She's also a very strange. So even though Peter is very successful and Howard is very unsuccessful, Peter keeps going to see Howard, because he obviously acknowledges that Howard is like a much better designer, and he will take problems that he doesn't know how to solve to Howard, and Howard will, in this sort of slightly exasperated way, tell him how to do them.
With a few slashes and thrusts of his pen. Yeah.
There's not that much to say about Howard, but he manages to talk his way into this job with Henry Cameron.
Henry Cameron is this figure who invents modernism. So he had been the book is notionally set in the 20s, in the interwar period. And Henry Cameron had been this big shot architect in the 1890s, had been doing all these buildings, and had like been utterly brilliant, and had slowly drifted towards modernism, and then had done a modernist building, and then the collective had seen that he'd done modernism and had done him down. Like, society has closed ranks and attempted to destroy him because he has because he's done a modernist building.
He's the only person Howard will work for, and he talks his way into a job with him. And he's working for him all the way through this period. But even the superhuman energy of Howard Rourke is unable to arrest the continuing decline of Henry Cameron's reputation and practice. And at a certain point, he suffers a stroke.
He's like this raging alcoholic.
Yeah. He has to go and get like scraped off the street by Howard. And so he's forced to retire. Rourke is forced to look for another job.
Like, the whole thing with Henry Cameron, that is like a few pages in a book where everything takes ages.
Also, I mean, the other thing is that everything happens multiple times.
Yeah.
And we're gonna elide quite a lot of the later part of the book because it's just the repetition of the same thing again and again.
But the Henry Cameron bit is very quick. All it's doing is establishing a sort of John the Baptist. And the John the Baptist then gets very drunk, has a stroke, and then lives this extended period of deathbed. For another 200 pages or something.
Yeah, so he goes off to live with a sister who takes care of him. Peter Keating, recognising Rourke's like exceptional characteristics, offers him a job at Francon and Heyer, and he goes to work there for a bit.
Well, first he takes over the firm and...
And burns everything. So he works for Francon and Heyer, but he says when he gets the job, I won't do any designing. Like, I won't design any of these fake classical things that you want to make me design. I'll just do the structure. But they do very well with that.
And he also just sort of does the massing and the planning. Yeah. And he does all the work for... basically, the way it works is he does all the designing, and then
Peter sort of sticks Peter columns on it.
Sticks some Doric columns on it, and it's all going well. And Peter, like, sort of mediates between the office and this artist, and, like, gets the most out of him. It's sort of like communicating with the boss and insulating him from the work environment.
So that's all going fine, but unfortunately one day Peter is out of the office on some project in another city, and a project comes in from someone who says, I was a fan of Henry Cameron's work, and I want a modernist building. And there's a meeting between Rourke and the principal where he says, of course he can't have a modernist building, we're going to have to stick Greek columns on the front. And Rourke is like, why do we have to do that? And they have a big argument, and he's fired. And this then sets the scene for this series of moves where he's going to work in sequence for a whole series of different architects.
And actually, there's some of the...
It's quite fun, these little caricatures.
I feel like when we have sort of really nice topics, I'm constantly finding the faults in them. And in this, I'm constantly trying to look for the things that are moderately worthwhile. There's some quite fun descriptions of these different workplaces, which is... It feels a bit like Alice in Wonderland. He's sort of going to this one sort of funny exaggerated setting, and then another one. There's also a bit of the love of money. He talks about his salary all the time.
So he goes, he has a series of job interviews. He goes first to see a dude called Gordon Prescott, who is like a young up-and-coming architect. So they have a kind of a chat, and so here's Gordon Prescott says things like, Architecture is primarily a utilitarian conception, and the problem is to elevate the principle of pragmatism into the realm of aesthetic abstraction. All else is nonsense. I have no patience with visionaries who see a holy crusade in architecture for architecture's sake. The great dynamic principle is the common principle of the human equation. So then he shows him a sketch. He said he extended the sketch to Rourke. The sketch represented a house in the shape of a grain silo, incredibly merged with the simplified emaciated shadow of the Parthenon. Which
sounds amazing.
Which, given that we've just been studying Aldo Rossi, which is basically all this kind of thing, I thought was quite funny. He's like, that's literally an Aldo Rossi building, isn't it?
Yeah. Grain silo. Well, no, he never includes the Parthenon.
No.
In his case, it would be a grain silo, a coffee cup, and an Etruscan house. But, if you wanted sort of pastiche Aldo Rossi.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And he ends up getting a job with this guy called John Eric Snight, who's quite an interesting figure because he's like a totally cynical architect who has different designers of every kind. And Howard Rourke becomes his like pet modernist architect. So he has five. Yeah, he has classic, Gothic, Renaissance, and miscellaneous. And he becomes modernistic.
Modernistic, yes, urban classic.
But in some kind of like weird way, the buildings don't end up in any of those styles. Like there's a house style, and what these different people represent is not a style, but an approach to designing the sort of skeleton and sort of spatial layout of the building.
It's just funny because, like, if that was true, it would be kind of amazing, wouldn't it? Be like you have this sort of collage system where, like, you give the thing, like, Gothic proportion and layout and then turn it into a modernist building.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
It would be very strange, yeah.
Sounds so weird.
Yeah, also it's kind of the
I mean, that's like Michelucci almost, or like,
yeah, there's this kind of weird thing where actually she's kind of come up with this quite cool scenario, this like totally cynical guy who like will embrace everything, but she can't actually allow Rourke to be designing modernist structures because then he'd be happy. So she makes it so that he designs these things, and then another person takes the drawing afterwards and paints on all this
weird,
sort of arts and crafts
it?
Kind
it's
of
so
detailing.
Weird.
It's all like green painted shutters. And,
I mean, again, quite a Rossian thing, the green window frame.
Yeah.
But we're giving her way too much credit.
Kind of psychic, it's terrible. Psychic anticipation of 80s Pomo.
But it's just not, I mean, but actually it's just her lack of imagination that's creating this. She's just combining stuff together to make it sound grotesque.
Anyway, Howard, like, gets into it a bit and he, you know, he has... He works at this place for quite a while, and he...
Is that where he strikes up bromance number something?
So he becomes, and during this time, he becomes friends with this solid, earthy, working man, Mike the Electrician, who will feature for the rest of the book.
Who's another properly strange character.
Yeah, it's very...
He's also like a sort of anti-socialist as well.
Yeah.
He's politically reactionary. He's like the ideal working class character.
It's kind of working class fascist.
He likes to work. He doesn't mind working for the plutocrats, and he supports fascism.
There's this moment where Rourke is on site, and he wins the approval of this guy by telling him that he can save some time by drilling through a beam.
Cutting through it with an oxyacetylene torch.
Yes.
It's very important.
Yes.
And the guy's like, what? I can't cut through that beam. And he leaps
in,
his veiny hands thrust...
thrust the torch.
Thrust the torch in, and he cuts a section.
Cut a hole in that beam and put your pipes through. What? Cut a hole through the beam. The hell I will. The hell you won't. Rourke took the man's gloves and goggles, took the acetylene torch, knelt, and sent a thin jet of blue fire at the centre of the beam. The man stood watching him. Rourke's arm was steady, holding the tense, hissing streak of flame in leash, shuddering faintly with its violence, but holding it aimed straight.
And after a certain amount of cutting slits and thrusting pipes through them, an enduring friendship is formed.
Yeah, they'll be buddies for the rest of the thing.
An obvious question: Like, these, like, grotesquely sort of Freudian bits go all the way through the book. There's a bit later on I'm particularly fond of when he gives her fireplace a good whack with his chisel.
Like, a feature of all of the descriptions of action, creativity, the creative process, is that there are acts of violence. And this is like, well, this was clear in the quotation we started the program with, where, you know, geology is violence.
But it's also sexual violence.
In a way, actually, the experience of reading it, you start to filter it out after a bit. But when you do the quotations, it's so obvious. So everything is like thrusting. Everything is penetration. Everything is slashing.
But and it's also forcing things into submission.
Yes, it is. Or like, or kind of tearing them apart. So let me just introduce this bit, because this is a really good example of it. There he is. He's this kind of submerged figure. Into the office walks this guy called Austin Heller, who is one of the kind of mouthpieces of Rand's philosophy in the book. He's this kind of libertarian dude, and he wants a house. They design him a house. Rourke designs him a house, which is this is kind of supported on this big craggy piece of rock, and it cantilevers off in all sorts of directions. And then the office, before showing it to him, they clad it in all these like red bricks and green shutters and things. And he says, they have a meeting, which they're all present at. Heller's like, it's the closest anyone's got to my idea of a house, but it's still not quite there. And Rourke grabs the drawing and quickly alters it. And I just want to read the description of that, because it's exactly this thing you're talking about. Rourke turned. He was at the other side of the table. He seized the sketch. His hand flashed forward, and a pencil ripped across the drawing, slashing raw black lines over the untouchable watercolour. The lines blasted off the Ionic columns, the pediment, the entrance, the spire, the blind, the bricks. They flung up two wings of stone. They rent the windows wide. They splintered the balcony and hurled a terrace over the sea. It was done before the others had grasped the moment when it began. Then Snipe jumped forward, but Heller seized his wrist and stopped him. Rourke's hand went on raising walls, splitting, rebuilding in furious strokes. What she thinks is that, like, strong men need to impose their will on the world and stop thinking about what other people want. They need to be purely egoistic.
There's a note in the first book where she says, I mistakenly used the word egotist
instead of egoist.
Subsequently, because of the poor quality of my dictionary. And then she references the dictionary. Then she says, subsequently, I have found a better dictionary. Egoist is the correct word, and but actually originally said egotist all the way through. In fact, the note at the beginning says, the work I regard as perfection, except for one major flaw.
She's
One major and one minor flaw. I can't remember what the minor flaw was. And the major flaw is that she used the word egotist instead of the word egoist.
What's the minor flaw? The minor flaw is that the one thing someone said could be construed as being in favour of religion, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Like, as if everyone would pay anyone would pay attention to all of the terrible conversations in this incredibly long book.
But apart from that, it is flawless.
She's such a massive dick. It's this is kind of her analysis of all of human civilization, is that everything good that has ever been done has been done by, like, a bold man imposing it onto the world as this kind of act of, like, violence and submission over others. And he may have paid for it with his life, but that's how it's been done.
I mean, after all, he had such a sparkling brown eyes. Did Hitler.
Yeah. I mean,
Like, this is written, like, in the dying days of the Second World War. This is astonishing. Like, the level of inappropriateness is absolutely astonishing.
Really, like, her critique of Nazism is that it's, like, a bit too socialist. That's it. Like, it's too much concern for the collective.
That's it. It's concern with other people. Yeah. The problem with Nazism is that it is concern. It's communal. In fact, what she says is, Nazism, communism and social democracy, they're all the same, and they're all evil because they're concerned. It's like, you are off your rocker. This is a woman who is off her rocker.
We haven't even got to the juicy bits yet.
No, so, there's nothing, but I mean, it's just absolutely bonkers.
So this, we're like reaching the end of the first kind of major part of the book here, because there's a big fight in the office. But, you know, the redoubtable Austin Heller says, no, I want this house the way he's just, like, quickly sketched it in, like, a blaze of motion.
and Rourke is sacked, and Heller takes him away to design the house anyway, and Rourke sets up his own office. And this is the start of Howard Rourke's kind of independent practice, building this house for this like Randian mouthpiece. So this is it. Like this is like his first kind of major architectural statement. This big sort of projecting cantilevering building on a rock,
which is clearly falling water or whatever.
Is it falling water? Yeah, I think this is falling water. And I think that one of the major like references for the architectural style is Frank Lloyd Wright. In this book, we'll discuss a bit more as we go on what the buildings are really like insofar as they're given to us, but this sort of sounds a bit like it. So he sets up on his own, he founds a little office, and he builds the Heller House, which he finishes despite the ridicule of all of the stupid local people who nickname it the booby hatch. Which I don't even know what does that mean in American, like.
Yes, some of the double entendre are definitely not intentional.
So he manages to get one more job as well. He like meets some kind of like uneducated, independent, working class man who wants a petrol station.
It was a great era of petrol stations. There's the Meese petrol station, which is very beautiful, and there's Frank Lloyd Wright did a petrol station.
I think the petrol station is my favourite of the imaginary buildings in this. It's sort of described as these like big sort of steel circles, kind of floating as an image of motion.
Yeah,
sounds nice.
Well, it sort of reminds me of those like huge like concrete canopy like mushroom ones.
"You the fellow who built the booby hatch?" he asked, quite diffidently. "If you mean this house, yes," Rourke answered. "Oh, I beg your pardon, sir. It's only that's what they call the place around here. You see, I've got a building job. I'm going to build a filling station of my own about 10 miles from here." You know, like all the heroes in this book, he's a guy who's worked really hard and saved up some money.
Yeah.
Yeah. And luckily, no one in his family has got ill or anything like that, you know. Well, he doesn't give a shit.
No, he's a good little Randian. He's shot them all, yeah. Granny was feeling a bit ill, so he did the generous thing and gassed her.
"My congratulations, Mr. Rourke. You've done a beautiful job."
"It's yours."
"On one minor condition." "Oh, it's just a small compromise. And when you agree to it, we can sign the contract."
"What is it?"
"Well, of course, we wouldn't alter your plans in any way. It's the brilliant ingenuity of your plans that sold us on the building."
"But its appearance is not of any known style. The public wouldn't like it. It'd shock people. It's too different, too original.
There's always a middle course."
"So we want to preserve your beautiful design, but just soften it a little with a touch of classical dignity. We want you to adapt your building like this. Now there's a touch of the new and a touch of the old, so it's sure to please everybody. And we must always compromise with the general taste, Mr. Rourke. You understand that, I'm sure."
"No. If you want my work, you must take it as it is or not at all."
What we're now establishing is this pattern, which we'll repeat 2 or 3 times through the rest of the book, where Rourke has this moment where he achieves something, the house, the petrol station, and then the world will, like, beat him down. And it will beat him down because he's unwilling to compromise with the other people who are prepared to offer him work. And gradually... He's sort of in for lots of jobs. It's this kind of quite fun section of the book where people approach him. There's sort of this woman, this like woman who's the wife of someone with lots of money who wants a house, and she's like, no, it's got to be a Renaissance. And then there's a guy who wants a copy of a house which he remembered from his childhood. And then there's like some big building.
It's sort of really incredible. What would you give for one of those? Any of them would be amazing. All these incredible...
It's just, yeah, this kind of cycle where he gradually has no money
like,
at all.
Like, as an aside, the way he works as an architect is like the way that the worst sort of person would work. Like, instead of being prepared to take on any interesting challenges, he's uninterested in challenges, he's uninterested in challenge, he's only interested in himself.
Yeah. He's running out of money... He has to stop paying the electric bill, all this kind of stuff. And at this moment of defeat, it's redoubled with another, which is that his mentor, Henry Cameron, has another stroke and is like is on his deathbed, and he goes to visit him. And I think the Henry Cameron deathbed scene is probably my favourite scene in this book, because what does he talk about as he's fading from the world, as he looks back over his life? But the potential of the plastics industry.
It's another classic, right? You should dig it out, and I'll. It's another classic thing where basically through this period he's been going through about he's had about six deathbed scenes where basically he's sort of he's been in this suspended state of dying.
Yeah.
For the last 200 pages or so, when you need a moment of pathos is sort of needed to be injected, Rourke will go up and visit his dying mentor, who will gird him up for the next sally.
I'm not sure whether maybe we'll... I don't know whether it's good to prefigure this or just allow it to be a surprise during liquidation. But anyway. On the evening of the third day, Cameron lay back on his pillow, talking as usual, but the words came slowly and he did not move his head. Rourke listened and concentrated on not showing that he knew what went on in the terrible pauses between Cameron's words. The words sounded natural, and the strain they cost was to remain Cameron's last secret, as he wished. Cameron spoke about the future of building materials.
Watch the light metals industry, Howard. In a few years, you'll see them do some astounding things. Watch the plastics. There's a whole new era coming from that. You'll find new tools, new means, new forms. You have to show the damn fools. Last week, I read about a new kind of composition tile, and I thought of a way to use it where nothing else would do. Take, for example, a small house about $5,000.
After a while, he stopped and remained silent, his eyes closed. I think the best thing is that this isn't even the only time that this happens. At times of great strain and emotional torment, people talk about the future of the plastics industry.
Also, the thing of talking about everything by the amount of money is something that goes through the entire book. Everything is measured in terms of money.
Yeah.
Like, in numbers. At one point, he goes from earning $60 a week to earning $65 a week.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a big moment. It's a big moment for him.
Oh, my God.
The plastic thing, I hear of desolating. desolating tiles. I hear you've got this new stuff called Trespa. It's going to be marvelous. Resin impregnated chipboard.
I only wish I could live to see the advent of acetylized timber composites. It's this, I mean, and that's how it's written in the book. It's got all this like ellipses and stuff. It's like kind of Yoda dying, but if all he cared about was petroleum derivatives.
Oh, God, plastics. It's also like that bit in The Graduate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where he goes...
Plastics.
Let me tell you something. Plastics.
Plastics. It's a bit mad. And
she was kind of wrong. Plastics, like, I mean, yeah, actually, no, it was going to have about 10 years after she wrote the book of real, maybe 15, 20 of, like, real ascendancy, and then...
It turns out they have some disadvantages as well. The what slightly...
This is a side note. There was a brilliant moment... when it was decided that a reasonable substitute for thatch, if you want to do an authentic reworking of your Cotswold cottage, was plastic thatch tubes.
Wow.
This was then undertaken in a few places. And first it was discovered they immediately failed under UV, but also were exactly the right size for nesting for this particular variety of flying insect.
Oh, wow. What, they nest inside it?
Yeah, yeah, and you know, like tubes. You get those, like, insect hotels. Anyway, this tube is exactly the right condition for this sort of wind insect.
Yeah.
And so you'd have these sort of roofs essentially made of, like, straws.
Yeah.
As in drinking straws. Crumbling to, like, plastic dust that was blowing all around. And then thousands of insects would emerge from them.
Yeah. Oh, my God. there's slightly buried in there is also this kind of like weird Randian ethic where Howard Rourke is he knows that he mustn't acknowledge the enormous suffering of this other human being. Like, the honourable thing is to pretend that this guy is, like, not in incredible pain.
Yeah, and just carry on talking about...
Well, which might be the humane thing to do, but it's not it's not about being humane. But, it's like...
Well, no. I mean, you will understand. If you've talked to highly enthusiastic and slightly sort of Asperger's people, they usually have one or two subjects of conversation. And actually, it's not really fair to expect them to talk about anything else. And if... she did have any understanding of emotions, I will put it down to that. It's sort of this one Asperger's man talking to another one.
About plastics.
As he gradually fails away.
Yeah.
But again, that's a massive overreading. Actually, he's not acknowledging his weakness because, one, other people's feelings are corrupting, and two, weakness is disgusting.
Yeah.
That's actually it. I have a problem with the way we're doing this, which is that we're making it look so much better than it is.
I think we've got to be absolutely, like, crystal clear.
You've got to be crystal clear. This book is disgusting.
Don't read it.
We're making it sound funny and interesting and sort of camp and comical. It's very boring.
Yeah.
It's very long and it's very offensive. It's just the same things over and over again. It's awful.
And also it gets significantly worse as it goes on. I mean,
I think we have to keep reiterating how bad this is.
We're talking about a 700-page book and we're not even at page 200 at this point. Right, so here we are. It's this place of defeat. Rourke is out of clients. He's out of money. The mental has died. He closes the office, but he's made a vow to himself never to work for another architect again, never to compromise in that way. And so instead he goes to work as like a hired labourer in a granite quarry in Connecticut. And it's to there which he repairs.
Which is incidentally owned by Guy Francone. And he's got it because then he gets everyone to make these weird granite buildings. Which is another thing I find deeply sympathetic.
Yeah.
I would love to be a megalomaniac architect who, like, buys up all the supply of some weird building material and then gets everyone to do things in it.
This must be a nightmare to do stone carving in granite, though. You wouldn't make... there's a reason...
You remember Porto? All the, like, Baroque sculptures are made out of granite. They are, yeah. They're all... And, like, it's very, very difficult.
Should we talk a little bit about what the Heller House is like? Have we said enough about it?
Oh, people know.
Yeah.
It's all these thrusting cantilevers.
It's all thrusting cantilevers. Okay, we'll leave it at that.
People know what Frank... Like, I think most of our audience has got an idea of what Frank Lloyd Wright, whatever it's called, Falling Waters, looks like. It looks like that. Except it's perched on top of a rock instead of on a valley.
Which probably makes it a bit less good. We're meant to read Rourke's story as a story of martyrdom, but he's a martyr for himself. Like, he martyrs himself for himself.
Yeah, which is what all the characters do. And there's a really interesting dual martyrdom. This is not the right point to talk about it, but I'm going to anyway because it's crossed my mind. And we can follow the path of Rand and say the same thing over and over and over again until people get thoroughly sick, which is that there are two. There's the martyrdom of Rourke, who is a martyr to his own brilliance.
Yeah.
And actually, it's very important for Rand that it's a romantic text. She talks a lot about romanticism, which she's got completely the wrong idea about. The thing she likes about it is the artist being the key. Like, it's not like classicism where the state is the key or where great, you know, or the public buildings. It's the wanderer in the sea of mist, you know. But the romantic hero suffers for his art, tormented to try and get the stuff out. There is no inner life of the Randian. He just suffers. He is like martyred on. Other people persecute him, but he will be true to himself because the ideal man is just a man who is born the Messiah and keeps true to himself. But there's also a dual martyrdom because a lot of the book is about Dominique and she suffers to deserve him.
Yes.
Like, in these, like, you know, Zsa Gabor died recently and famously said about one of her late husbands, "We were both in love with him, but I fell out of it."
Yes, that's absolutely it, isn't it? Yeah.
Now, they're both martyring themselves to him. And that really is what the book is about. It's about he crucifies himself on society only to defeat everything.
Yeah.
And she crucifies herself on him in the hope that eventually she might suffer enough.
To be
a woman, the only thing you can do to make yourself valid is to suffer.
Look, this is sheer insanity. Can't you give in just once? After all, you have to live.
I think at this point we might... It's slightly annoying because the most important bit is yet to come, but I think at this point we might take a little break because we've already recorded quite a lot. So here we are.
It's easy with these literature ones, isn't it? I can just get you to read it all out.
Yeah, we're at this place of apparent defeat. Rourke in the quarry.
Defeat, apparent defeat number like 2 or something. Yeah, out of like 10.
In the movie, this is like very well depicted with Gary Cooper, who plays the hero, sort of drilling, drilling
he's
into
he's
these rock faces.
Thrusting his hearty drill into that.
Yeah, into the rock face. Like for no apparent reason, I don't really know why he's doing it.
But also, he's not like they don't do anything to the rock.
Yeah, no.
There's a bit when he really like, and also they're not the drill isn't moving.
Yeah,
he's just like going, and he's sort of like. He sort of like rubs it a bit.
But maybe, so actually, maybe we'll just set it up a bit. So at this same time, so Rourke is in the quarry. He's in like the heat of the sun. And at the same time, Dominique Francon, the boss's daughter, has also gone to stay in their place in the country, which is close to the quarry, where she, she goes so she doesn't have to talk to anyone. And she gallops around on her horse. And obviously, the two are going to meet. But we'll talk about that next time. So thanks a lot for listening.
Look forward to some lovely, like, horse crop beating. There's some good scenes. But not as good as they should be.
All kinds of stuff is going to happen, and it's going to be quite...
Oh, and also look forward to it being immensely offensive. There needs to be a real trigger warning for the next section.
We haven't even got into, like... I know we said at the beginning, but we haven't even got to the really horrible stuff. It's going to get a lot worse.
And there's quite a few, actually, really horrible things.
But you've got all that to look forward to. So, until next time.